Alrighty, we're going to go ahead and get started tonight. Got a slide up on the screen there. Wicked smart, I love that. So for those of you that may be listening online and cannot see, I will read a cartoon to you and I'll try to describe it as best I can. There's a man talking to another man. And the man at the first frame says, "Are you seriously asking me to justify why I believe there is no God? The evidence is so overwhelming. I wouldn't even know where to start, man." And the other guy's looking at him like, "Okay." But the guy with the shirt on, or the guy that's talking, it says Wicked Smart, S-M-A-H-T, on his shirt. Just love that. So, next frame. If I can get my mouse to work. There we go. The other gentleman says, "Where else? Start at the beginning of everything." The other guy says, "By this, I assume you mean before the Big Bang, right? As in, how did everything seemingly come from nothing? On this point, I agree with most scholars and hold to the tree theory of the beginning of everything." Tree theory? "As the name implies, the best way to explain the beginning of everything without resorting to a creator is to start by observing a tree, like that one, right over there." The other gentleman turns around and he goes and looks at a tree. He says, "Okay." Still looking. And he turns around and says, "Are you going to explain?" And the other guy's gone. I thought this was super funny because this really illustrates well the arguments or the lack thereof for there being no God. By the way, this comes from a guy's website, adamford.com, adamford.com, part of the ability to show that required that I tell you that. But at any rate, really funny. I thought it was hilarious, especially considering what we talked about last time with the propositions for the beginning of the universe. Yes. Yes, on the backs of crystals, correct. Huh? Yeah. At any rate, thought we'd start out with some humor tonight. So, all right. So, we are going to be picking it up tonight and discussing the subject of teleonomy. And teleonomy is basically just a fancy word for saying that when something shows purposeful design, it has a designer. That's essentially what it was. We started talking about this a little bit last week, and we worked through a few basic premises of teleonomy. And first of all, the universe does show purposeful design. We see it everywhere, and we talked a little bit about this before, but we do see it everywhere. And so we want to talk about some of the most basic elements of the teleological argument. Let me get back to my notes. We covered these last time, so I put them in the back here. All right, so just as a quick review, the most basic elements of the teleological argument are that, one, if the universe shows purposeful design, there must have been a designer. Pretty straightforward. The universe does, in fact, show purposeful design. And, of course, number three, thus the universe must have had a designer. These are the most basic arguments that you can boil the whole concept of teleonomy down to. We talked about these a little bit last week. Oops. So one of the examples that you can often use is called the watch argument. If you were to find one of those old wind-up watches, very, very simple compared to what you see today in watches and smart watches and, you know, watches that take your heart rate and tell you you're eating too much or not getting enough exercise or whatever. These, this very simple wind-up watch, even as simplistic as it is still very complex. And if anyone were to find a watch laying around, nobody would pick it up and say, "Wow, look at how those pieces organize themselves together to form this watch." They would pick it up and realize that it had a designer at one point or another. So when we look at the universe, and we will look at really anything in the universe that has form, and really things that don't seem to have form, we notice that there is a designer inherent in those things. So one of the things we talked about, too, was the pale blue dot. And just for the sake of those who didn't see it last week, days without his laser pointer. This dot right here is Earth. That photo is from the Voyager spacecraft. You can see it there. Maybe you can see it there, a little tiny dot. That is from the Voyager spacecraft taken just outside the orbit of Pluto. Now, this, anybody want to care? Anybody that didn't see it last week want to guess what that is? It's the rays of the sun. Huh, isn't that amazing? That far away, and you can see exactly where the sun shines right on the Earth. Huh. Almost like it was designed that way. But anyway, go ahead and turn the lights back on, Sue. Thank you. So the pale blue dot is an interesting photo in a lot of ways. It makes you feel, if nothing else, makes you feel small in an immense universe. This photo was taken, as I mentioned, by the Voyager 1 spacecraft on February 14th, 1990. It was taken from 4 billion miles away at 32 degrees above Earth's elliptical orbit. So if the Earth's orbit is like this, it's taken up like this from 4 billion miles away. Okay? Long, long, long distance away. So the thing is that this dot seems really insignificant in the general scheme of the universe. And as Carl Sagan wrote, he basically said that there had to have been hundreds of thousands of other planets sustaining complex life forms. It's Carl Sagan. If you know anything about Carl Sagan, he was a prolific science fiction writer, had a massive effect on that genre of literature and of movies and television. But at any rate, he was certainly not a believer at all, very much an atheist. But anyway, he wrote the book called The Pale Blue Dot and basically made his premise that there must be hundreds of thousands of planets that are in fact sustaining life, complex life forms. Now, one of the things that I want to point out here, besides that little pale blue dot, is the fact that the universe is absolutely immense. It's estimated to be 20 billion light years in diameter. A light year is not a regular year with less calories. It is the distance light travels in a year, okay? So light travels at approximately 186,000 miles per second. Long story short, a light year is approximately 5,865,696,000 miles, okay? So here's the thing. So the estimated diameter of the universe is that number you see at the bottom. In miles, yes. So, just in case you were wondering, I'll read that for you. 117 octillion, 313 septillion, 920 sextillion. That's a huge number, and the only reason I know what it is because I wrote it down. Okay? That's a huge number. And this is what we can see of the universe. This is what we know, what we can observe, and part of this is really based upon an estimate, obviously. We can't travel out that far. Now, there are a lot of different variations in the estimates, but the point is it's huge. The universe is absolutely immense. And the universe is estimated to contain more than 1 billion galaxies, not just stars, but galaxies. And remember, galaxies are made up of hundreds of billions of stars. So yeah, there's a lot of matter out in the universe, huge, huge amounts of it. Okay? So there are approximately 10,000 billion stars that we can see. Also a very large number. Okay? And there are 100 plus planets orbiting nearby stars. And when we say nearby, we're talking many, 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 many light years away. But nearby stars in nearby galaxies, and nearby in the astronomical sense, there are hundreds of exoplanets. We can detect them in various ways. We can prove that they exist. And interestingly enough, every time they find another one, guess what you hear in the news? Oh, we found another planet. Is it like Earth? Every time. Can it sustain life? Every time. Doesn't matter if it's too close to the sun or too far away. It doesn't matter if it's a gas giant. They're always looking for life. Okay? And your tax dollars are paying for that. Just so. Make your day a little brighter. So, the universe, as I mentioned, is immense. Just a few pictures to help you understand some of the beauty that's in the universe, as well as the immensity of the universe. It really is very, very difficult to comprehend. So this is where we want to pick it up tonight in some detail. We want to talk about what makes the Earth so special. So given the size of the universe and the billions of galaxies and the hundreds of billions of stars within those galaxies and the hundreds of planets around those, possibly, around those stars and the hundreds of billions of blah, blah, blah. So given all the immensity of the universe, what is it that makes the Earth so special? Well, there are factors, of course, involved in having a habitable planet. And we're going to talk about some of those factors. They are very numerous. There are many, many factors required to produce a hospitable planet. But we're not going to talk about all of them. We'll talk about several as we move on here. All these factors that are required to create life operate in three elemental truths that are the same no matter where you're at. Okay, we talked about these a little bit last week. First of all, the basic laws of science in all fields, whether it's chemistry or biology or geology or anything in between, all fields, those laws of science function exactly the same way everywhere in the universe. Okay? So gravity, while it is lesser the further you get away from large objects in space, it still has an effect on the entire universe. Gravitational waves, that's something they proved here they've released the information within the last couple of months, but it's been worked on for about the last year and a half. Gravitational waves are real. Gravity is real. Doesn't matter how far away you get in the universe, gravity exists. Also, the unchanging physical laws apply everywhere in the universe. Same basic point, except that we're dealing with physical laws here. We don't have to talk about the laws of information. We know those things are universal and non-material, so of course those things apply to every material entity. But unchanging physical laws apply everywhere in the universe. Okay? And of course, the factors necessary for life on Earth are the same factors necessary anywhere else. So those three elemental truths are at the core of this discussion. So there are six factors that we are going to consider, and these are really pretty simplified. There are a lot of multiple factors, but there are six primary factors. Anybody guess what one of them is? What are they always looking for? Every planet they look for liquid water. Not just water, because water can exist as a vapor and also as ice. But they always look for liquid water or evidence of past liquid water. Always. Okay? Obviously, water is a big deal. You have to have plentiful amounts of water as well. It's not just like, you find a teaspoon worth of water on the planet and all of a sudden you have life. You need to have plentiful amounts of it. And there has to be a water cycle involved in that. We'll cover a little bit more of the water cycle as we get through some of these. Also, the planet has to have a molten core, a melted core, and a magnetic field. And we'll talk a little bit more about these as we move through this, so I'm just going to list them first. It has to have a large moon. It has to revolve around the correct type of star. Now, this is important. Well, they're all important. Well, and if we talk about these, you'll understand why, of course. It also has to have the correct kind of an atmosphere. Not just any atmosphere, because, Jupiter has a fantastically thick and wonderful atmosphere, right? Have you ever seen pictures of Jupiter? You see that large red dot? You know what that large red dot on Jupiter is? It is a storm 1.5 times the size of the continental United States that goes around the planet all the time. And it's not like that storm's dumping rain, at least not liquid rain. It's ammonia, most of it. So not exactly what you'd call a real hospitable environment. So it has to have the right kind of atmosphere. And of course, last, it has to have the correct placement within the galaxy. Not just within the solar system, but also within the galaxy. Oh, one thing before I move on. I had to make a correction to what I said last week. That's the problem with trusting your notes when this... I read a quote from G.K. Chesterton, and even my slide was wrong. I looked at that and thought, man, that can't be right. G.K. Chesterton died in 1936, not 1986. Big difference, just so you know. I wanted to make sure I corrected that. Okay. So, So those are the six factors that need to be considered when you look for life on any other planet. So let's talk about some of these a little bit. We'll talk about the first one of liquid, plentiful liquid water. This is a foundational element, and the properties of water are amazingly perfectly suited to support life. Carbon-based life, of course. The existence of liquid water on a planet hinges upon its distance from the sun, by the way. If that planet is too close to the sun, or too far away, you're going to have some issues. As you probably know, the Earth is covered with over 70% of the Earth is covered in liquid water of one form or another. So you look at the oceans, of course. They're, of course, have a large salt content. You look at the freshwater, a lot less salt content. 70% of the Earth, over 70, it's somewhere around 78%. Of course, you talk to the climate change folks, and they'll say, oh, it's all over for us if we get one more percent. Well, that's debatable. But at any rate, over 70% of the Earth is covered in water, so it's obviously a very important factor for us. And if the, as I mentioned, if the planet is too close to the sun or too far away, its water cycle can't work. Okay? So, if the planet is too close to the sun or its star, the water is boiled off. Okay, so the closer you get to the sun, the hotter it gets, obviously. And so the water would be burned off and not allowed to be a part of the water cycle. If it's too far away, the water is constantly frozen. Also, not a part of the water cycle. So as I mentioned, when they're looking for water on a planet, they're looking for liquid water. Not just the existence of ice, not just the existence of possible water vapor, which you wouldn't have, but you have to have plentiful liquid water. The Earth exists in what is called the Goldilocks zone, called the circumstellar habitable zone. It's not too far from the sun, it's not too close, and we'll cover that here in just a moment. But the Earth has a consistent water cycle. This is one of those things that, yes, despite the fact that we live in Montana and it never rains here, it does actually rain here. We do have humidity somewhat in the air. There is a consistent water cycle that's always refreshing the water that you drink, including some of the air that you breathe in that has water vapor in it. And it's been said that the water on the Earth has been recycled through every human being many times. Kind of creepy and gross to think about, but that's the reality. Its water cycle is very efficient. So, as I mentioned, the existence of liquid water on a planet, it hinges upon the distance from its star. Too close, it's boiled off. Too far away, it's perpetually frozen. As I mentioned, the Earth exists in a perfect zone in our solar system, and our solar system actually exists within a perfect location within our galaxy as well. We're not too hot, we're not too cold, we're just right. Okay? Just to give you a couple of examples here, if we were 5% closer, the Earth would look like Venus, enduring 900 degree Fahrenheit daytime temperatures. Only 5% closer. Okay? That's a pretty significant jump. There's not a lot of SPF that can help you with that. If we were 20% further away, the Earth would form carbon dioxide clouds, and the planet would freeze as Mars is frozen. So we're in a perfect location. Now, you think about 20% further away. It's quite a distance, actually. Life would cease to exist much further or much sooner than a distance of 20% away. It would be uninhabitable. Okay, but at 20% away, the Earth would be without an atmosphere that's breathable. So let's talk a little bit about the molten core and the magnetic field. Without a magnetic field, the Earth would be stripped of its atmosphere and lifeless. The Earth's core is liquefied iron. Okay, interesting thing about liquefied iron is that it creates a magnetic field. Okay, so the crust of the Earth, stuff that we walk on, is between 4 and 30 miles thick, depending upon where you're at, and it's broken into sections that float on that molten core. Okay, so the circulation of that melted iron core creates a magnetic field called the Van Allen belt, and it surrounds the Earth and keeps us from being basically stripped of our atmosphere by the sun. Yes, Mike.
I'm just curious. How do we know what the center of the earth is?
That's a good question. What's his name? Do you understand? What's his name? H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells went there and he told us all about it. It's actually based upon many, many pieces of information, one of them being seismology, as well as they take temperature variations on the Earth's crust. And also some of it is conjecture. Some of it's based upon the mathematical proofs that they can find to illustrate the movement of the continents or the plates on the Earth itself. And ultimately, a lot of it comes from the generation of a molten core, or excuse me, the existence of the magnetic field. Okay? So, this circulation of the core creates a magnetic field. Looks something like this, if you were to visualize that. Of course, I don't think the Earth is that flat. Sorry, I didn't straighten that slide. But you get an idea of what this magnetic field does for the Earth. Okay? It keeps the Earth from being stripped of its atmosphere. Without it, the Earth would not have an atmosphere, we would not be able to breathe, it would be a lifeless planet, we would not be here. The solar winds that blast the Earth on a regular rate are pretty intense. Anybody ever heard of the Carrington event? It was in the late 1800s. I can't remember the date off the top of my head. But the Carrington event was when there was a massive solar flare that hit the Earth. Okay? And this solar flare that hit the Earth wiped out all communications across the planet. Now, it's the late 1800s, so it's not as prolific as it would be today. But the Carrington event wiped out all electronic forms of communication, which are essentially telegraphs at the time, completely wiped them out and blew out every electric device on the planet. It also melted railroad ties or railroad tracks because the amount of static electricity that built up in them. Look it up when you get home. It's interesting. So that's a solar flare. Okay, our magnetic field protects us from those constant barrages of solar flares. Every once in a while there'll be a big one and it hits us and it wipes out all electrical devices. Not going to go there. So, prepare. Oh, wait, no. So, definitely some important things to consider for the molten core and the magnetic field. How about the size of the moon? The Earth has a relatively large moon. It is at 1/4 the quarter of the size of the Earth, and it helps to regulate and maintain that perfect tilt of 23.5 degrees that we enjoy. It also helps to maintain a mild climate and gradual seasonal changes. Now, how many of you have ever been to the ocean and seen the tide come in and go out? I think you probably know the moon controls that. As the moon goes around the Earth, it basically, its gravitational field, literally pulls the water off the Earth, and so as it travels around the Earth, the moon, or the water, basically follows the moon. That's what causes the tides to come in and out. Okay? What's that? And that part of this is that it's called tidal pumping. And we're actually going to talk quite a bit about that as we get to the hydroplate theory, because tidal pumping, it was one of the primary factors for the buildup of pressure in the pre-flood crust. And we'll get to that when we get there. So, a large moon is another necessity for this, for the Earth. To survive and to have life. As I mentioned, it circulates the oceans via the tides. And, of course, the next piece being the type of star that the planet revolves around. Ours is a spectral type G2 dwarf main sequence star. So the sun is basically a massive nuclear engine. It gives off more energy in a single second than mankind has ever produced since creation. 1 second. More energy. Okay? It's massive. 8 million tons of matter is converted into energy every single second. 8 million tons. The sun's internal temperature is more than 20 million degrees Celsius. It's big, it's hot, it's very efficient, and it burns a massive amount of fuel per second. Okay? And it gives us, helps us to have life. It's the perfect size, as I had mentioned. Now, the perfect size is one that, if the sun was less massive, as 90% of the other stars in our solar system are, the Earth would need to be closer to maintain life. However, with a closer distance to the sun, the increased pull of gravity from the sun would actually stop Earth's rotation. So you can already see that there's an interaction between the two. Okay, the sun is the right size, and we're the right distance away from it to get the right amount of radiation to keep the Earth spinning and hot and cold and seasonal temperatures and gradual changes and so on and so forth. But if the sun was smaller, we have to get closer, and then the Earth stops rotating. And then one side of the planet would be essentially dead and burned to a crisp. The other side of the planet would be frozen and dead. And there'd be a very small band around the northern equator, northern southern equator, that would actually be able to sustain life. Okay, so we're at the right distance from the right size of our sun. Next factor we want to talk about is the Earth's atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere is designed... The Earth's atmosphere is designed in such a way that we absorb the right amount of radiation to produce complex life, but a lot of the excess amounts of radiation is filtered out. So those harmful UV rays that give you a suntan or a sunburn, if you're me, you know, I don't think I've ever had a tan in my life. I go outside and I'm lobster. You know. But my kids, on the other hand, you know, Emma, she gets a lovely tan and she always shows it off. And yeah. I just burned to a crisp. But the atmosphere is designed in such a way that a lot of those harmful UV rays are filtered out to allow life to exist. One of the outer layers of our atmosphere, it's called the mesosphere, it's about 12 to 18 miles above the Earth, contains a special form of oxygen known as the ozone layer. How many of you have heard of the ozone layer? Oh no, and chlorofluorocarbons, and there's white. Oh, wait a minute. Never mind. I'll have a whole theory on that one. But anyway, so, of course, ozone, it filters out most of those ultraviolet rays from the sun that would be harmful or fatal if it was in larger amounts. Now, the inner layers of the atmosphere are approximately 1% the size of the Earth's diameter and is comprised of the perfect mix of nitrogen, oxygen, and less than 1% of carbon dioxide. So it's 78% nitrogen. So that's one of the reasons why the sky is blue, by the way, because of the nitrogen in the air. 21% of it is oxygen, less than 1% of it's carbon dioxide, the rest of it's trace amounts of other gases, including things like helium, etc., etc. And our atmosphere is unique. One of the ways that it's unique is it actually allows us to see out. So when it's dark, when you're driving home tonight, I don't think there's much of a moon tonight, but and you can get away from the lights, look up and just look at how much you can see. On most other planets in our solar system that have any kind of an atmosphere, if you were actually on the surface of the planet and were able to survive, of course, you would not be able to see out through the atmosphere. If at all, if you did, it would be a little tiny bit every once in a while. That would be the least of your concerns. But our atmosphere is very, very unique. And I thought I had another piece here. No, I didn't. Okay, let me go back a little bit. So you can see this this top left picture here that you're looking at, that blue band there, that's the atmosphere around the Earth. It's pretty wild to think about that little itty-bitty band compared to the rest of the size of the Earth. That's what helps to keep us alive. There's, of course, another picture of the Earth on the daytime side there, but I always find that interesting to look at horizon pictures of the Earth from space. That's amazing. I mean, that little tiny blue band keeps us from being crispy and keeps us breathing. Yes, sir?
Isn't it also true that the shape of our system that we're in such a shape that allows to see in discovering how big the universe is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and we'll get to that. We're going to get to that. I promise. Maybe not today, but we will get to it. Yeah, and so and what Mike was saying is that the shape of the galaxy in which we are, and where we are in the galaxy allows us to see a tremendous amount of the universe around us. And we'll watch a video probably after this section before the next one that goes into a little bit more detail on this that will show that and illustrates it very well. Yes, Brad. How thick is the atmosphere? You know, I don't have that number, but it's less than 1% the diameter of the Earth. So it's not very big at all. So, at any rate, so anyway, I wanted you to see that, just to kind of give you an idea of what that's about. So, let's talk a little bit about the probabilities for the factors necessary for creating a planet that can sustain life. These are the factors that you can see on the screen here, and each one of those represents an individual factor that's required for life to exist on this planet, and this is how they are expressed. Notice the X's, those are not factors, that means multiplication, just so you know. I mean, I'm not necessarily being silly, but that's what they're for. They're not factors, those are multiplication. Okay. So, if you were to work out the calculations on the information or on the probability of a planet existing elsewhere in our universe, you would arrive at a very, very large number. So, before you get to that, you have to understand what the approximate value of each of those factors is. So, being very, very generous, and if you look at the one where it says 1 divided by 10 or 1 over 10, that basically means that 1 out of every 10 chances you'd come up with is possible with this factor necessary. That is exceptionally generous in terms of the probability. Exceptionally generous. Most of those are much, much higher. The probability is much less that you're ever going to come up with any of these things by accident, like, for instance, the size of the moon. Okay. So, anyway, put those factors to a number, you multiply all of it together, and you end up with a very large number under a very small number. 1 over that number. And that number is 1/1,000th of 1/1,000,000,000th of a chance of having a planet such as Earth. That's 1/1,000th of 1/1,000,000,000th of a chance of having a planet such as Earth exist anywhere in the universe, given very, very gracious, if you will, factors. Yes?
And isn't that true that it's that small factor because each of those factors has to happen simultaneously?
Yep, exactly. And the reality of that is exactly what Mike mentioned, that one factor, the existence of these factors by themselves, they're great if you can find them in the universe, but they have to happen all at the same time, and literally all at the same time so that life can exist. It's not like you can have the first half of them start life and then add the rest of them later. They all have to be there at the same time, and they all have to stay in tune as well. So, again, using the example of the size of our sun and the distance we are from it, those two things have to remain constant. If one of them changes, our distance from the sun, or the size of the sun changes, we're in a lot of trouble. Okay? So the probability of another planet existing anywhere in the universe is very, very small. And actually, if these guys, like I said, these guys did 1 to the 10th, or 1/10th possibility in a lot of the factors, a lot of the numbers on that should be closer to 1 in 2,500. So, just one of those being that much larger significantly changes this number. Being very generous with the probabilities, though. So, the likelihood of another planet existing is basically quite small. So, the last factor is our galaxy placement. This is what Mike was talking about. So, the placement of our solar system within the galaxy is also essential to its existence and to the existence of complex life. So, in this artist's conception, because none of us have ever been able to see the galaxy from this direction, is that little, that bright pink star there kind of in the center, that's essentially where our solar system sits within the galaxy. It exists within an area that is called the galactic habitable zone. Our galaxy, as you probably know, is called the Milky Way, and when you're out at night, and you know, if you guys ever go to, for the guys that go to Peaks, it's beautiful, it's dark, and hopefully there's no moon, and you can see the band of the Milky Way go across the sky. It's absolutely gorgeous. So what you're actually seeing is the other arm of our spiral galaxy as you're looking on flat from the horizon. Okay? We have a spiral galaxy, as I mentioned. It is highly flattened in that it is very wide compared to its height. Looks a little bit like a fried egg, actually. It has a spherical bulge at its center. It's the conditions are exceptionally dangerous in the center of the galaxy. It has a very high density of stars with supernovas, which are exploding stars, and a giant black hole. So not a place you'd want to be. And there's also, you know, consider the multitude of stars that are at the center of the galaxy, and consider the amount of radiation that would be at the center of the galaxy compared to where we are. Okay? So not a place that you'd want to live. At the outer edge of the galaxy, there aren't enough heavy elements to facilitate the creation of a terrestrial planet based upon current models. So, in other words, our planet is unique even in reference to looking at it from an atheistic or evolutionary perspective. Because our placement within the galaxy, there aren't enough heavy metals existing to create the planet, much less all the planets in our solar system. Okay? So, the galactic habitable zone is sometimes called the Goldilocks zone of the solar system. But our planet exists in exactly the right place to not only allow us to have life, but also to see out and to see a tremendous amount. So, the solar system, as we've mentioned, exists in this center, or in this area. The galactic center is the most dangerous, of course, and the outer edge doesn't contain enough heavy elements. We'll watch a video on this, possibly next week if we get to the rest of the notes tonight, that helps explain this. It does a great job of kind of walking you through it and helping you really understand and realize how blessed we are to be where we are. The video is called Privileged Planet. I know a number of you have seen it, but it's fantastic and it's well worth watching. At any rate, the galactic habitable zone, as I mentioned, allows us to be able to see out. Within the zone, within the galactic habitable zone, there are large areas that are inhospitable to life. Large areas. Actually, most of it is inhospitable. We just happen to be, by golly gee willikers, by chance, in the right spot in the galactic habitable zone to allow us to have life, to allow us to exist. In order for a planet to have life and exist, it needs to be between the spiral arms. Can't be in the middle of one of them. You ever notice at night that it gets dark? If you were in one of the arms, it would never be dark because there's too many. You'd be too close to too many stars. Our solar system is between the Sagittarius and Perseus arms. So, if you ever wanted to know. And our placement in the galaxy, as I mentioned, is the best location for discovery. We're able to look out and see a tremendous amount of the stars around us. So the conclusion from this section is that the presence of the obvious design in the universe, allowing for the existence of complex life forms, leads us to the logical conclusion that there was/is a creator. The factors necessary for complex life are numerous, they're very complex, finely tuned, and they all had to have happened exactly at the same time. Much like many of the other things that we'll talk about when we get into the next section, which deals with the examination of the origins of life. Very, very similar. And of course, it is equally amazing, if you really stop and consider it, that the Earth is the perfect location to allow us to discover through science the very laws that govern the universe. I find this interesting. I think Albert Einstein said that the most amazing thing about the universe is that it is explainable, that we can actually discover it, we can learn about it, we can understand the laws of physics, and we can understand calculus, and we can understand geology, and we can understand all those things. It's amazing that the Earth is really an amazing creation of God, so that we can actually look out and find these things out. That's how we know what the methods that are used to discover other planets. The methods that are used to determine the shape of a galaxy. I mean, those things are amazing in and of themselves. So, at any rate, it really is pretty amazing to consider it. And the way that Albert Einstein put it, to quote him correctly, is the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. And this really is amazing when you think about it. So, this wraps up our section on teleonomy. I realize it's been a very, very brief discussion, but hopefully it introduces you to a few subjects that you can begin to maybe explore on your own. And hopefully gives you a little bit more information on things that hopefully will spur your interest and you'll find out a little bit more about them. What we're going to be picking up with next week is we're going to be looking at the origins, or not next week, we'll probably look at the week after. Next week we'll watch a video. It's about 45 minutes long or so. I think it's 45 minutes to an hour long. It's called Privileged Planet. It'll cover what we just talked about in teleonomy and placement within the galaxy and so on and so forth, and help explain some of that. Week after that, we'll start looking at the origins of life. Now, the origins of life is another example. Hang on just a second. I'm thinking of my calendar in my head. Okay, it'll be 2 weeks. I'm here next week, which will be the 10th, and then I'm gone the 17th. So no class on the 17th, okay? So, on the week after that, which will be the 30th, we'll start on Origins of Life. Any questions or comments before we close for the night? All right. Thanks for your time.